clerk will call the docket. You may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Maureen Carr. I'm counsel with the law firm Reese Broom and Tyson's Corner, and I represent the plaintiffs, the Funny Guy LLC, and Mark Goldstein in this appeal. Your Honors, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Factually, this appeal relates to the application of res judicata to two lawsuits involving separate contracts, operative sets of facts, and causes of action. More broadly, it tests the appeal of Virginia Supreme Court Rule 1:6, on the common law regarding res judicata. The facts of this case are simple but relevant to the issue on appeal. The parties entered into an oral agreement under which the plaintiffs agreed to provide certain information technology services on a multi-tier government contract, and the defendants were to pay plaintiffs for those services. The relationship between the parties terminated, and a dispute arose regarding payment and other post-termination issues. The parties negotiated a settlement agreement, which the defendants ultimately disavowed. In a prior lawsuit, which I'm going to call Lawsuit 1, plaintiffs sought specific performance of the settlement agreement, including both monetary and non-monetary terms.
May I interrupt you there? At the time of the filing of the settlement claim in Suit 1, the oral contract breach obviously had previously accrued. Is that right?
It had, Your Honor.
So you had two accrued rights of action arising out of a single dispute, which was the original oral contract between the second tier sub and the third tier sub. In every other instance where the same transaction occurrence test applies, you would have to bring both claims in the same suit. You couldn't segment them. Why should it be different here?
Well, Your Honor, our position is that these two claims do not arise out of the same dispute. They do not arise out of the same transaction or occurrence. They arise out of entirely separate contracts that were entered into at different times, were breached at different times, and therefore constituted different causes of action.
Well, they're different rights of action, but the dispute was the original dispute between Funny Guy and the second tier sub.
Well, Your Honor, I think the disputes actually were different. So the settlement agreement resolved a number of issues, not just a payment dispute between the parties, but other termination issues. At the time the relationship ended, my clients were then looking for alternate employment. And some of the other terms of the settlement agreement, such as the confidentiality provision, the non-disparagement provision, the mutual general releases, were just as important to my clients as the underlying payment issue.
Right, but that doesn't get you anywhere, because the settlement agreement clearly addressed the entire dispute arising out of the oral contract between the two subs.
Well,
that it may have addressed other things might implicate other preclusion principles, but it certainly doesn't diminish the preclusion principle applicable to the second suit.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, we disagree with that position. Pursuant to the restatement of judgment, Section 24, which is essentially what Rule 1:6 is founded upon, there have been a number of other jurisdictions that also have rules that follow that provision of the restatement, and there are many decisions from other courts that would be in line with what we're asking here. For example, I've cited in the brief the Gilmore versus Family Link case from Utah and the Spectris versus 1997 Milton Hollander Family Trust case from New York in 2014. Those cases both related to similar situations and both found that res judicata did not apply. In the Gilmore case, there were actually three lawsuits involving the same parties and involving the same plot of land. Those disputes all related to two roads that connected the plaintiff's property to a highway. And the court in that case in Utah found that res judicata did not apply, that there was no common nucleus of operative facts, even though it related to the same property, because it related to the same property at two different points in time, which is also the case here. The settlement agreement was negotiated and breached in 2014, whereas the underlying payment dispute arose in 2012 and 2013 when the contract was not paid.
The restatement, second, that you referred to has concepts in it that we have not previously embraced. And I guess I'm exploring to the extent to which you are suggesting we ought to. It talks about facts that are related in time, space, origin, or motivation, and whether they form a convenient trial unit, and whether the treatment as a unit conforms to the party's expectations or business understandings or usage. Address how to answer Justice Kelsey if we were to embrace the restatement.
Well, Your Honor, I think that we can embrace the restatement and apply it in a way that is consistent with what we're asking here. The two causes of action here arose at different times. They had different origins, and they had different motivations. In lawsuit one, which was related to the settlement agreement, the motivation was not just to recover an amount. And by the way, it was a different amount than the amount that's being sought in lawsuit two. It could have related to any number of other issues as well. The motivation was also broader than that. My clients wanted to protect their ability to obtain alternate employment. And a non-disparagement agreement, a confidentiality provision, a release, those kinds of things would really benefit my client. Those are all motivations and origins that are completely unrelated to the payment dispute. And, Your Honors, I think that the most factually applicable case really here is Bates versus Devers, which was decided by this court in 1974. I recognize that that was before Rule 1:6 was amended, but essentially, my understanding is that the purpose of Rule 1:6 was to clarify that the transactional test applied to res judicata as opposed to the same evidence test that was set forth in Davis.
So is Bates, in your estimation, the best case you have for the support in this case?
I think it is. Unfortunately, there simply haven't been that many cases decided by this court interpreting res judicata. There was the Lee versus Spoden case from last year, but that case, that addressed the difference between a cause of action and a right of action. It didn't necessarily have facts that are particularly relevant here. So I think Bates is the most applicable case.
Well, let me ask you this then. In Bates, the first lawsuit, the federal court lawsuit, was filed in 1962. The settlement agreement was entered into, didn't exist in 1962. It was entered into, as I understand the record, in 1968.
That's
but
correct.
Under all genres of res judicata, the cause of action that accrues after the filing of the first case is not barred by merger and bar. So Bates is a bit of a no-brainer from that perspective.
Your Honor, I would concede that the order of events in Bates is different than in this case, in the sense that the settlement agreement was entered into when the first suit was actually pending. Although I will say that in 1968, when the settlement agreement was entered into, the first lawsuit was ongoing. It didn't terminate until 1970.
But the rule is that the cause of action has got to accrue at the time the first suit was filed. Otherwise, there would be a mandatory requirement to join every claim in anticipation of a later res judicata defense.
Right.
And there is no compulsory joinder that is required by res judicata.
I understand that. But I think that the difference in the order of the claims does not change the ultimate fundamental analysis in Bates, which was that what we have here, as was the case in Bates, was distinct divisible claims depending on separate contracts made at different times and upon different principles. When the settlement agreement was entered into in
this
case...
But you stop mid-sentence. The sentence continues to read, and the evidence to support one is not necessary to support the other, but much of it would be... Much of it that would be material to sustain the one would be irrelevant to the other. That's the same evidence test, which was the very test 1:6 was meant to displace.
And I agree with that. I mean, frankly, I think that the bar needs the court to clarify whether Bates still has relevance. It was cited by this court in Lee versus Spoden, which I take to mean that it must have some ongoing relevance. There have been circuit court opinions since Rule 1:6 was amended that suggest that what Rule 1:6 did was really codify the transactional test from Bates. So I think it's the burden is now on this court to explain how that actually impacts the ongoing relevance of Bates.
Well, look, Bates is the same evidence test, and that was the key filter of Bates, and 1:6 was obviously meant to abrogate that. How can it not be obvious?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily agree that that was the key component of Bates. I think that Bates may have merged a same evidence test with a transactional test, but this court in Bates still applied the transactional test, and that is still being cited by courts. So if Bates has no ongoing relevance, I think that's something that this court needs to explain here.
Well, I don't want to take all your time up, but if Bates still applied the same transactional test, why did Davis come out the way it came out? Why did the dissent in Davis say this is not a same transactional analysis that you've done?
I think that's something, I unfortunately can't explain that. I think that that's an ambiguity that this court needs to clarify. And I think this is an opportunity for the court to clarify what the impact of Rule 1:6 is. There haven't been significant cases, in my understanding, that have come before the court that would allow the court to do that, and this is a good opportunity for it. I think that what we are advocating here is entirely consistent with Lee versus Bowden, which is this court's most recent ruling on res judicata. And that case distinguished between a cause of action and a right of action. And what we have here are two separate wrongful actions by the defendant, which we've discussed before. I'd like to briefly address the defendants assert in their opposition that the lawsuits seek payment for the same disputed work and seek to recover for the same injury. Again, I don't think that that's an accurate interpretation of what happened here. The first lawsuit, which related to the settlement agreement, related to much more than a disputed amount. And it did the settlement agreement did involve a payment from the defendants to the plaintiffs, but it was a different amount than what is being sought here. And it also included other very significant terms that, from my client's perspective, are just as important as those payment terms. And finally, Your Honors, from a public policy perspective, I think applying res judicata to this case could have far-reaching implications. If the circuit court's ruling in this case stands, it would establish a precedent that any party asserting a claim for breach of a settlement agreement would also have to assert all of the underlying claims that were released by the settlement agreement, or they would risk having what happened here happen. If for some reason the settlement agreement is deemed unenforceable, then they are barred from ever bringing any of those underlying claims. I think that if that's the rule of law, this court needs to articulate it, and I think that that will ultimately overburden circuit courts, and I don't think that that's consistent with Rule 1:6. Unless there are more questions from the bench, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Helsel. I am counsel for Appellees Lasigo LLC and Heather Cogdell. I do not represent Toni Shannon. She is here today and she would like to address the court, so I'm going to try to sit down at about the 10-minute mark to give her a few minutes to address the court. Unless the court has questions, still leave me at 10 minutes, in which case we've agreed I should answer them.
Well, counsel, I'm going to have a few questions.
Okay.
And I'm going to start where your opposing counsel left off, because as I try to think through how this is going to apply out there in the real world that's not up on a bench in Richmond, Virginia, it seems like an unholy mess. I've got a lawsuit, $100,000. It's going to be difficult to try it. It's going to take a whole lot of time to try it. And my client says, settle it for $25,000 if we can get our money right away. So settle it. And then the settlement agreement is breached. Does my client have to elect whether to proceed on the settlement agreement or whether to proceed on the underlying lawsuit, first of all? Is there an election that has to occur right from the start?
My position is you have to join those claims, and especially whereas here you say in your question that there's been a breach of the settlement. Here there was no settlement. It was known before lawsuit one had been filed that the settlement agreement hadn't been signed.
Okay, you answered my question. You have to join them both. So she is correct. If you go into court with the settlement agreement, you're actually going to have to go into court with your underlying complaint as well. Okay. Now, second question. What if there's a confession of judgment provision in the settlement agreement? How do I then do it?
I think what you do there, I mean, first off, you go to the clerk's office and confess judgment.
Res judicata
no,
then applies?
Finish answering. Then the defendant, the ostensible judgment debtor, has the right within the 21-day period to challenge the judgment. And if that judgment is challenged with a showing that, hey, there is no settlement at all, at that point in time, I think the plaintiff, under the could have, should have principle, because I think it's undisputable that all the claims, as a matter of joinder principles, could have been joined together. I think it then follows they should have. So to get back to your confession of judgment hypothetical, If there is a dispute as to the existence at all of a settlement, set aside whether it's been breached, but whether there's a settlement, I think it is incumbent upon the plaintiff to either do one of two things. You can elect to say, hey, my strongest argument, my underlying claims aren't very strong. I'm going to put all my eggs in the basket of I have a settlement and litigate that. That's fine. Or alternatively, if you want to pursue all the claims arising from what I believe is clearly a common definable factual transaction, then you bring them all together. And that's just prudential from the attorney's point of view, because keep in mind here, this alleged settlement, no settlement exists. The alleged settlement in this case was unsigned. Counsel, my client's former counsel, okay, told them no settlement.
Your case is quite interesting, and I certainly will allow you time to present your case. I really am much more concerned about how this spins out and whether it spins out of control. So, okay, you go into court, you've now married a very simple settlement agreement and potentially a very complex complaint into the same cause of action, into the same case, one file. And at that point, if the judge gives you judgment on the settlement agreement, which might occur in an hour, at that point, have you waived the other half, the other count of your case, which is the underlying complaint?
Not if you've brought it. Not if you've alleged it and the court chooses to enter judgment on the settlement, rendering moot at that point the dispute of the other claims that have been asserted.
But what if your settlement agreement has a contingent release that's contingent on payment, so that the claims are being released once the payment is completed? You then have a judgment on the settlement agreement, but you don't have a release of the underlying complaint because the payment hasn't yet been made.
Well, you still, and again, all your questions are premised on there being a settlement, okay, which is in our case. But I agree with you, Justice Mims, that this case, the principles of this case are more important than just this case. Okay, this case is a relatively simple case. However, I don't agree with your concern. I think your concern can be addressed in terms of the practical applications of the principles I'm espousing. I actually think the concern...
I'm not sanguine about it yet. So tell me something more that will make me more comfortable with what might be happening out in the real world if you prevail.
I think in the real world, under the could've, should've principle, and the court said this about 100 years ago, every litigant is entitled to a fair opportunity to bring his or her claims before the court, arising from a definable transaction. Once you had that opportunity, you're expected to take full advantage of it. Okay, so trial courts are well able to deal with claims involving multiplicity of claims. I think what the dissent's concern in the Davis case, for example, was not bringing multiple claims in one lawsuit, but having a dispute pieced or picked apart into multiple lawsuits. And I think that is the concern if you were to accept Ms. Carr's position. What it would mean, not just in a case involving a settlement, but in any case, a definable transaction, factual transaction, can be artificially deconstructed into smaller component pieces, and then a creative lawyer can try to argue, hey, the smaller component pieces are individual transactions. Going to our case...
Well, particularly if there are alternative theories of recovery.
Correct, and it's important to remember, in both lawsuit one and lawsuit two in this case, Funny Guy was seeking redress for the same injury, which is the failure, or the alleged failure, to pay money it claimed it was owed for the exact same
work. But your opposing counsel just pointed out there was a lot more at stake in the settlement.
Well, she points out that there were some monetary settlements, and she says that it was important to her client, but there's no evidence in the record to suggest that. She didn't put on her client at trial. I, as the appellees, are the prevailing party, and I think the record needs to be looked at in the light most favorable to the prevailing party. And I think that gets to, I do think there's an interesting standard of review question in this case that really the court hasn't addressed. True, you've twice said in Caperton and Roden that issues of res judicata are reviewed de novo, but Caperton involved pre-Rule 1-6. It didn't involve the same transaction test at all. And Roden straddled the adoption of Rule 1-6. It involved a 2005 sexual commitment hearing and a 2011 sexual commitment hearing with the same exact legal question, or with a statute that resolved on a statutory legal question. But de novo review cannot be the standard of review for every issue relating to res judicata. One, I think, obvious example is if we were debating whether defendant in lawsuit one and separate defendant in lawsuit two were privies. The court wouldn't review a determination that they are or aren't de novo.
Can I ask you this question? As a matter of black letter contract law, if you settle a case, that is a new and separate contract. Do you agree with that?
I disagree.
If you settle the case.
Well, assuming you settle it, which you didn't hear, I disagree with that proposition. I mean, the law on novation, as I understand it, is novation, which would result in a separate contract, is never presumed. And going to Joint Appendix, page 438, section or paragraph 10 of the alleged settlement agreement, it said the payment would be made in the amount of $73,290 as final payment under the verbal agreement, which is what I call in my briefs the oral subcontract. So clearly, the alleged settlement agreement and the oral subcontract are intertwined. They are not independent of each other. Ms. Carr says she's found several cases that supposedly support the modern view of res judicata.
How are they related? You say that they're not independent of each other, but once you have the settlement agreement, it doesn't matter what the claims were in the lawsuit. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is whether or not you reached an agreement concerning the amount of money that was to be paid.
If the same evidence test were still the law of Virginia, Justice Goodwin, I would agree with you, and I would lose if the same evidence test. But what we're talking about is the proof needed to make the claim. But the reality is these are all part of the same transaction. If you look at the Rule 20, Section 24 of the restatement, it speaks of the idea of a broad sense of transaction. To say that the settlement and the underlying dispute being settled are separate transactions makes sense from a common sense perspective.
Counsel, before you sit down, I have one more question.
Yes, sir.
One more hypothetical, and I'm going to actually hold very closely to your facts with this hypothetical. Funny guy files suit on the underlying contract and gets a judgment. Post-judgment, the funny guy enters into a settlement agreement with your client, and then the settlement agreement is breached. Mm-hmm. Can the funny guy then not file suit on the settlement agreement under your res judicata principle?
No, the funny guy can, but it's for the reason that Justice Kelsey said in response to Ms. Carr's argument. There, the breach of the post-lawsuit, post-judgment settlement occurred after the first lawsuit was filed, so you couldn't bring the claim. Again, the could've, should've principle is what answers the question here. And before I sit down, and I will sit down in a second, I want to offer, I don't think it's that, and it goes to your point, Justice Mims, about concerns.
What if after that first lawsuit was filed, there was a confession of judgment that was signed and a settlement agreement, but the agreement was to hold the confession of judgment pending the settlement agreement?
It wouldn't matter because the breach would occur in the future. The could've, should've principle operates from the time the first lawsuit is filed. What claims existed vis-a-vis this transaction? You're expected to bring all of them. If you could have brought them, and they conceded below they could, then you should, and you are required to bring them, or else suffer the bar. Two really quick hypotheticals, just to hopefully allay your concerns about pragmatic issues. Settlements, disputes about settlement are commonly litigated in disputes of the underlying, or lawsuits involving the underlying disputes. Here's two obvious examples, I think. Funny guy, there's no settlement talks pre-lawsuit one, and funny guy brings a lawsuit alleging oral contract. Okay, there's a subsequent discussion of settlement, and one party thinks that the parties have reached a settlement and the other doesn't. So the party who thinks a settlement, a post-filing settlement has been reached, files in the underlying lawsuit a motion to enforce the settlement, and the judge figures out if there's a settlement or not. That's one. Say, then, even perhaps a little closer to our hypothetical, although the tables are turned, or our actual case, the tables are turned, it's my clients who think a pre-filing settlement has occurred, and funny guy thinks none has. So funny guy goes out and files a lawsuit, one, alleging breach of the oral subcontract, and my client says, wait a second, we settled it. We then assert that as a defense to the claim, and it's litigated in connection with the underlying dispute. There is no concern, in my opinion, of unworkable problems by applying the could've, should've principle. I think it is the law of Virginia. I think it's the aspirational goal of Rule 1-6. And for all those reasons, including the standard of care, I'd ask that you affirm Judge Ortiz's raised judicata rule.
Madam Clerk, stop the clock.
May it please the Court, Tony Shannon.
Wait just 1 second. You are a party to this case.
I am.
And so you're representing yourself and not anybody else because you're not admitted to the bar, correct?
That is correct.
All right. I just want to make sure that all those ground rules are... Your time isn't running, so don't worry about it. I just want to make sure you understand the rules that you are representing yourself as a party in this case. You have, Madam Clerk, you didn't stop the clock. Put 2 minutes on the clock. She has 2 minutes, and you may begin now.
Okay. First, I'd like to say that the funny guy states, no less than 9 times between brief, that a settlement agreement was negotiated and entered into. And I object to that language. It's been stated many times that a settlement agreement was negotiated and entered into, but in the lower court, it's found that there was no agreement, that there was no contract. And so I simply take objection to that language. It seems to me that the funny guy now wants to either seek a declaration from this court that there was a contract or either relitigate the fact that there was not. And I believe that that's no longer open for litigation. And what that means to me is that we're really left with one single transaction to consider here, and that would be the oral agreement and the dispute that arose out of it. Okay? So we do have a ruling there, and I'm assuming that everyone's familiar with that. But to go further, I'd like to take it a little bit further. In case you're wondering if you should consider whether the plaintiff even thought there was an agreement, you know, the answer to that question would be simply no. And I state that for a couple of reasons. And the first reason is because had they thought there was an agreement, they would not have redacted emails that concealed the evidence that there was no agreement. Okay? When the motion craving order, the redacted emails were unredacted, and that showed that there was no agreement, that there was an offer, counteroffer, and ongoing discussions. Number two, if they thought there was an agreement, then they wouldn't have made a specious allegation against me, which basically stated that my co-defendant's counsel represented me in the settlement negotiations. Okay, and it was fortunate for me that the emails were unredacted, and they also proved that my co-defendant's counsel did not represent me. And I...
You continue. You have a few more... not minutes, but you have about 15 or 20 more seconds.
And so I think it begs the question of then why would they not bring all of the claims at the same time? Okay, and I think that we have an answer for that as well. I think that, first of all, the facts that were known at that time, the facts as they knew them, the facts as they alleged them, and the facts as we confirmed them would not support these cases or these claims that they currently bring in lawsuit to. I think that if you have an agreement between two people, you cannot then allege that four people breached it or four people benefited from some oral contract. So what do? You end that lawsuit and you go and you allege some different facts and then you bring another. And I believe that that's what happened here.
Thank you. Your time has expired. We appreciate your argument. Thank you very much for bringing it to us today. Rebuttal.
May it please the Court. I would like to respond to a few points made by Mr. Helfel. First of all, I think that the hypotheticals raised by Justice Mims are very, very real issues that the Court needs to seriously consider when deciding how to rule on this case. In the real world of litigation and the Court's resources, if every single lawsuit that asserts a breach of the settlement agreement also has to include all of the potential claims that were settled by virtue of a settlement agreement, that is going to be a mess for the Court.
But I had a question about that as well. What happens to statute of limitations issues? If you have a settlement agreement that actually has performance into the future, it's entirely possible, it seems to me, that the statute of limitations would have run on the former issues that this particular case suggests need to be raised now.
That could be an issue, Your Honor. I don't have an answer to that question. That wouldn't have been the case in this case because the settlement agreement did not have terms that went out into the future.
Well, suppose it did. What would happen?
You mean what would happen to those underlying claims?
You couldn't bring them.
I suppose in that instance, then it might make sense. There would be a strategic reason to assert those underlying claims in the lawsuit alleging breach of the settlement agreement. But that would be for strategic reasons related to the statute of limitations.
So you think it's more practical for the circuit courts of Virginia to handle the same merchandise twice, depending on the strategic reasons of the claimant?
I think that could be more efficient than having to bifurcate all trials because there is an issue regarding a settlement agreement, and then if that isn't resolved in favor of there being an enforceable settlement agreement, then having another trial related to all of the other issues, which seems to be what Mr. Heltzel is suggesting.
But you know, that impracticability from your perspective exists all over the law. You can't have quantum merit simultaneously with, for example, an express contract. It's an alternative theory that only applies when your express contract claim fails, right? But no one would say, oh, we should have a trial first on the express contract, and if I can't get mutual meeting of the minds on the express contract, then I'll file a second lawsuit later for quantum merit. It's just an alternative theory of recovery for the same exact dispute. And I hear what you're saying, but basically that segments all the alternative claims on the theory that it's so much more practical to handle it in seriatim, which I was a litigator as well, and I don't get that at all.
I certainly understand your point about that, and I don't think that the court's ruling, if it were to rule in my favor, would necessarily have that impact on asserting alternate claims. The problem here is, in a settlement agreement, including this one, there's often a general release related to almost any claim that the parties could have had. And if the party asserting a claim for breach of that settlement agreement has to assert claims for any claim that they could have had, that's going to wreak havoc on the court system that is already overburdened. A couple of other quick points.
My question to you actually was far more friendly than you realized.
I apologize.
It seems to me that it's almost unworkable that if you had a settlement agreement with its own statute of limitations, because it's a contract,
right,
and there were performance aspects of it that reached out into the future, you could have the statute of limitations that has long since run on the original action that you're now required to bring, and you're out. It seems to me that I don't know how you, it certainly wouldn't be told.
I would agree.
All right. Good answer.
Well, I see I'm out of time, but the plaintiffs would respectfully request that the court overturn the circuit court's ruling. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Call the next case.